message is quite clear. Do not come. The border is closed. The border is secure.
It's going to get a lot worse. Springtime, summer, more and more come over. The message is coming back that, hey, we got a new president. Come on in. We're open for business to the traffickers. And guess what? They're right here.
Don't leave your town or city or community.
In the spring, more people do come. So there will be more as there are now. But they have to know, as the president has said, don't come.
Joe Biden needs to get down here to the border and look at exactly what he's done.
We know how to address it. We have a plan. We are executing on our plan, and we will succeed. This is what we do.
President Biden's administration is struggling to respond to the increased number of unaccompanied minors crossing the southern border. As of this weekend, Customs and Border Protection said there were more than 5,000 minors in its custody. Many of them have been held in Border Patrol facilities for longer than the 72-hour maximum required by law. And lawyers who interviewed minors held at one of those facilities earlier this month say children reported overcrowding and insufficient access to showers and sunlight. Recent increases due in large part to the Biden administration's decision to stop using a Trump-era public health order to expel unaccompanied minors at the southern border. Instead, the Biden administration is setting up temporary holding centers for some of the minors. So far, media outlets have not been allowed access to these facilities. I'm Tanzina Vega, and assessing the Biden administration's response at the southern border is where we start today on The Takeaway. Camila Montoya Galvez is an immigration reporter for CBS News, and he joins me now. Camila, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me.
Who are the children we are talking about, and where are they coming from? What ages are we talking about?
That is an excellent question. More than 9,400 unaccompanied minors entered U.S. border custody last month. That is a record high for a February, Tanzina. The vast majority of these minors that were apprehended in February hailed from Central America's Northern Triangle, which is comprised, as you know, of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Many of them are teenagers who flee poverty-stricken communities in Guatemala. Some of them are fleeing gang threats in places like Honduras and El Salvador. Gangs are known to recruit teenagers in the region to partake in criminal activity. The region has also been hard hit by recent devastating hurricanes that made landfall last year, and it is still recovering. So there are many different push factors that are contributing to the sharp increase. But as you mentioned, there has also been a policy change in regards to this population. The Trump administration, invoking a public health authority, decided that it was going to expel most border crossers, including unaccompanied children, during the pandemic, under the premise that they could spread the coronavirus if allowed to enter and continue their immigration proceedings here in the U.S. The Biden administration made the policy decision, Tanzina, not to expel unaccompanied children, but it is still expelling and using that public health order to turn away migrant adults and some families with children.
I was just going to ask you, Camila, whether or not that meant that families were being separated. And what you're saying is unaccompanied minors who arrive at the southern border are being allowed in, families and independent adults are not. Is that a correct way to assess the current administration's approach?
That is 100% accurate. The Biden administration has continued to use this Trump-era public health order to expel most migrant adults and some families with children, but it made the policy decision to protect unaccompanied children from these rapid expulsions.
Let's talk about the facilities that are now being created to house these children we're hearing. Now, of course, we should note, as we noted in the introduction, that media so far have not been allowed access to any of these facilities. Has that changed, Camilo?
It has not changed. The Department of Homeland Security, which oversees Border Patrol facilities, has yet to allow journalists inside these facilities during the Biden administration. The Department of Health and Human Services, which operates state-licensed shelters as well as emergency facilities for unaccompanied migrant children, has also yet to allow journalists to enter some of these facilities. Both departments have cited coronavirus restrictions for not yet allowing journalists to enter these facilities, but they both have said that they are working to facilitate visits and tours. They have already allowed members of Congress and others to tour the facilities, but obviously we are still waiting for them to allow journalists like us to enter these facilities.
What do we know, given that there haven't been any media allowed into these facilities so far? What do we know about the conditions that we are hearing about? We're hearing some reports that some of these children are saying they haven't showered in days, that they don't get adequate access to the outdoors, to sunlight. We know that the Associated Press at least reported that the Department of Health and Human Services has stopped sending minors to one of the centers in West Texas because of a alleged COVID-19 outbreak. So what is really happening behind the scenes at a lot of these facilities so far? What do we know?
Sure. So for context, Border Patrol has usually 72 hours under U.S. law to transfer unaccompanied children it takes into custody to the U.S. Refugee Agency, which is an office located inside the Department of Health and Human Services. Border Patrol is a law enforcement agency that oversees dozens of stations across the U.S.-Mexico border that were built to primarily detain adult migrant men. These are facilities that have cinder block cells, usually with one toilet. Migrants have dubbed these stations dog kennels and even ice boxes because of the cold experience there. Border Patrol does have one facility in South Texas specifically designed to hold unaccompanied minors and families with children, but even that facility, Tanzina, is designed for short-term custody. And what we know is that according to attorneys who interviewed some of the children detained at this facility in South Texas, the children have reported taking turns sleeping on the floor because overcrowding. They reported not seeing the sun in nearly a week, and showering once in as many as 7 days. So these are obviously poor and not ideal conditions for children to be held in. And the reason for this massive backlog of children in these unfit Border Patrol facilities is because the U.S. Refugee Agency, which is in charge of their long-term care, is currently scrambling to find bed space for the high number of children entering U.S. border custody.
Was the U.S. Refugee Agency not prepared for this, given the previous couple of years where we've seen surges at the border?
That's a great question. What we know is that the U.S. Refugee Agency during the Trump administration had to downsize its bed capacity to implement social distancing. So the agency has more than 13,000 beds for migrant children, but it had to reduce that capacity to about 8,000 beds. Right now, the agency is currently holding more than 10,000 children, so it is way past its COVID-era capacity, and it is scrambling to expand beds that had been taken offline during the pandemic, as well as to establish new emergency facilities like the one you mentioned in Midland, Texas, as well as a convention center in Dallas to house some of these migrant children. But to be frank here, Tanzina, the agency is going to need to open a lot more facilities and potentially activate more beds in order to reduce the 5,000 figure of unaccompanied migrant children currently stuck in Border Patrol facilities.
Camilo, tell us a little bit about what rights these children have when they come to the United States. Do they have the right to legal counsel? Do they have other rights that that will help them navigate this process?
Sure. So under U.S. law, unaccompanied children, unlike migrant adults and families, are protected from expedited deportations. They are supposed to be transferred, as we mentioned earlier, to the U.S. Refugee Agency, and they are connected with lawyers and sometimes with child advocates, depending on their circumstances. The children are allowed, unlike adults, to undergo their asylum proceedings before an asylum officer at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, rather than in a courtroom setting before a judge and an ICE attorney that will seek to deport them. That is the situation that migrant adults and families face, but unaccompanied children are allowed to undergo these child-sensitive interviews. So in addition to asylum, they can also request visas that are designed for children who were abused, neglected, or abandoned by one or both parents. So they have multiple avenues to request humanitarian relief in the U.S., and they have broader access to these humanitarian programs than adults. But again, it is important to note that the Trump administration suspended all of these legal safeguards this past year because of the pandemic. The Biden administration has reinstated them, and it is now struggling to logistically find a way to house the number of children coming in.
This, Camilo, is obviously something that is not an isolated incident. The fact that, as you mentioned at the top of the conversation, a lot of the unaccompanied minors that are coming to the United States are fleeing persecution, gang warfare, really coming here for their own safety and well-being. But the United States historically has had a role in conflict in Central America. And in some ways, you could even point a direct or indirect line to our involvement in the political instability that some of these Central American countries are facing. To that end, what has the Biden administration done or said to the leaders of many of these countries where many of the unaccompanied minors are coming from? Has there been some sort of international outreach to work together to solve this problem?
Yeah. So for context, the Trump administration really focused on implementing policies designed to deter families, children, and adults from coming to the U.S.-Mexico border. The Biden administration has said that those deterrence policies were ineffective, and inhumane.
So, but they're still saying don't come.
They're still saying don't come, but what they're arguing is that they shouldn't come because the borders are closed because of this public health order and because the journey is a dangerous one. They've promised to reinstate programs like the Central Americans Minors Program instituted during the Obama years that allows some children in Central America to come here to reunite with family in the U.S. as long as their relatives have legal status here. So obviously they have broadened the legal pathways that these children can employ to come here. But, you know, it will take some time for those policies to have a direct impact on the current numbers we're seeing. In addition to that, it has also asked Congress to authorize $4 billion in foreign aid to these three Central American countries to try to curtail some of these push factors like poverty, violence that are plaguing some parts of the region.
I wanted to ask you, you are covering this issue, but you're also sort of, as many of us are, watching how the rest of the media, the media in big quotes here, is covering it. And you had a Twitter thread earlier this week talking about some of the themes that you're seeing. Where do you think media outlets are getting this story right versus getting it wrong?
Sure. Well, I think it is fair to report and highlight the dire humanitarian consequences that are currently happening as a result of the high number of children coming into U.S. border custody, the overcrowded conditions that they're facing, the scramble to find bed space for them, and the logistical problems that the Biden administration is facing to deal with this influx. But I think it is also important to understand that this is not, in my opinion, a national security crisis. This is a direct result of these push factors that we mentioned in Central America that push many of these families and children to come here. It is also important to note that many of these children and families have been waiting in northern Mexico for months and even years, but were not allowed to seek asylum during the Trump administration because of all the different policies that were instituted over the past 4 years that restricted or even barred their ability to seek protection in the U.S. So I think it is important to just contextualize that. And it is also important, Tanzina, to note that the alternative that some are proposing to allowing these minors to come in is to expel them back to Mexico or to their home countries. And that policy also has humanitarian implications. Many of these children would potentially be returned to danger, as we have reported on this past year, because that indeed happened during the pandemic. Many children fleeing domestic abuse, gang violence, and other factors were returned to their home countries, and their parents were not notified. And so that is important to highlight, that there is really no easy solution to this issue right now. Both choices have humanitarian consequences, and it is important for the public to just weigh in and consider all of those factors.
Camilo, finally, there were reports a couple of months ago about multiple children, unaccompanied minors who had been separated from their families here in the United States. Hundreds of children, in fact, that were said to have been separated from their families, and now the U.S. government is unable to track down all of their families. Has there been any movement on that front?
Well, the Biden administration created a DHS-led task force to specifically locate parents and children who are yet to be reunited after they were separated by the Trump administration during the zero tolerance border crackdown in 2017 and 2018. Many parents, according to the American Civil Liberties Union and other lawyers representing the families, are still in Central America waiting to be reunited, because the big issue, Tanzina, is that during the Trump administration, the government did not agree to allow located families who are still separated to reunite here on American soil. It only allowed parents to choose to either allow their children to live here in the U.S. with sponsors, or to return the children back to Central America so they can reunite there. Attorneys and the American Civil Liberties Union are pushing the Biden administration to allow these families to reunite here on American soil, rather than forcing them to make this choice of allowing the children to be here and continuing to be separated, or being back in Central America, where some of them are fleeing certain danger.
A critical topic, and one we'll be staying very close to. Camilo Montoya Galvez is an immigration reporter for CBS News. Camilo, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tanzina.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Jerry Seinfeld on making a life in comedy.
This is a writer's game. If you can write, you succeed. If you can't, you will not make it. Any comedian can be funny on stage, but the bullets are the writing.
Jerry Seinfeld on his film Unfrosted and more. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Last week, the House of Representatives voted to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act, and now it heads to the Senate, where its future is unknown. The Violence Against Women Act was first put into place in 1994, and it established legal protections for victims of violent crime. And while the act has been updated a few times since, it lapsed in 2019. Among many changes, the latest iteration seeks to ban those convicted of domestic abuse or stalking from being able to purchase a firearm. It also allocates money for tribes to address the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. But last week, 172 Republican House representatives voted against the reauthorization. And as the act heads to the Senate, Republican senators are also expected to oppose it. With me now is Lee Zoe, congressional reporter for Vox. Lee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So the Violence Against Women Act has been around and was signed into law in 1994. It has had different updates and reauthorizations. What have been some of the most significant changes to the legislation since it was renewed in 2019?
A lot of the major changes have been to make the bill more accessible and more inclusive. So, for example, in one of the recent reauthorizations, the protections in it were extended to also cover same-sex couples. And that was a key provision that lawmakers are trying to continue to build upon.
We know that this reauthorization is coming at a time where, you know, it was reauthorized right around the time that the Atlanta shootings of multiple Asian women occurred. We also know that it's happening at a time when the global pandemic has exacerbated the rates of domestic violence because of people having to shelter in place. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, was any of that sort of behind the impetus to reauthorize this bill?
There definitely has been a sense of urgency in this reauthorization because of what we've seen during the pandemic and the reports about domestic violence rates spiking in this time. At the same time, Democratic lawmakers in particular have been pushing this change for basically a few years now, and it's effectively been blocked repeatedly by Republicans, even prior to what we've seen with coronavirus and prior to the tragic shooting last week.
Let's talk about how the vote broke down in Congress. 29 Republicans in the House joined Democrats in supporting the reauthorization, but there were 172 Republicans in the House who voted against it. How do you explain that?
It's only more recently that we've seen this Violence Against Women Act become more partisan. And one of the biggest reasons is because the current version includes a provision that strengthens gun control protections. And that's something that Republicans have spoken out against numerous times. And it's also something that we've seen the NRA lobby against very strongly. And that particular issue has been a repeated sticking point.
And I'm wondering how, I mean, this is something, Lee, that it's on its face, it sounds, the Violence Against Women Act sounds like something that anybody would get behind. Is the politics here getting in the way of protecting American women?
It is. The new bill is intended to increase funding to a whole slew of programs, including programs aimed at rape prevention, programs aimed at helping survivors find new housing when they need it. And the gun control provision really is intended to close a loophole that exists. So currently, if a person is convicted of domestic violence, they are barred from purchasing a firearm, but only if they are married to the person who was involved, or if they lived with or shared a child with that person. So what this bill would do would basically make dating partners also part of the group that's barred from holding a firearm.
And is that the point of contention for Republicans, that only people, I'm just trying to understand why, particularly in an era where the NRA themselves have become a very weak political body, at least on the surface, at least their own organization has taken a bunch of hits, why this is still such a point of contention?
Yes, yeah, that particular issue is of concern for Republicans because they argue that it would make that ban too sweeping, that it would include too many people, and that this is really an infringement of Second Amendment rights, not just an attempt to protect violence against women, when actually, when you look at states that have implemented their own versions of this law, states that bar firearm ownership of dating partners see 16% less in homicidal, you know, crimes related to this issue. So there is a direct correlation between what this law could do and the effect that you see. The other issue that's come up for Republicans is that this law would also encompass more protections for transgender women, and that's something that they've repeatedly raised as a problem that they have as well.
So do the Republicans have competing legislation that they'd like to introduce that would protect the lives of women?
The Senate is currently working on what lawmakers hope is going to be a bipartisan law. At this point, they haven't introduced a competing version yet. And last time this happened, one of the big things was just stripping out some of the provisions we've talked about. So less so, I think, making specific changes that they wanted to add, and more so just narrowing down what the law would do.
We should be clear that not all Republicans voted against the bill. What can you tell us about the Republicans who voted for the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act?
So Brian Fitzpatrick is a Republican who sponsored the law last time around, as well as this time. And I think he is among those who's argued what we've talked about, that this is a bipartisan issue and that this is something that should be reauthorized on a bipartisan basis. So there is a group of Republicans interested in doing that. But right now, what we're looking for in the Senate is 10 lawmakers to join Democrats. And at this point, it's unclear if they have that exact number.
Lee, talk to me a little bit about the changes on how violence against women will be handled on tribal lands.
One of the biggest issues that's been experienced in tribal lands is that tribes are unable to prosecute crimes that take place there that are committed by non-tribal members. So what that means is that Native American women have been one of the groups that's been most susceptible to sexual assault, with no way of really following through on prosecuting those potential crimes. And what this would do would enable tribes to prosecute sexual assault and expand their ability to hold offenders accountable on this front.
In this legislation, $40 million is being allocated for programs that would assist communities of color with domestic abuse and violence. Tell us why that money is being allocated specifically.
One of the biggest issues that the bill is trying to address is making sure that people who haven't had access to services are able to get them. So those grants specifically would go to programs that are helping groups that maybe aren't getting reached right now. And so those are programs like language access for hotlines, so people are able to report potential incidents, as well as support with things like immigration services, because immigration status is an issue that survivors might need to navigate if they're trying to get out of a potentially abusive relationship.
President Biden has called domestic violence a pandemic within a pandemic. We know that the rates of domestic violence have increased during this pandemic. What else is there available to victims of domestic violence right now? Does President Biden have other initiatives, or is this pretty much meant to address that?
The upside of this being a reauthorization is that the programs that were established in the original Violence Against Women Act, so grants for things like legal aid, for housing, for medical care, those are all still in place. And what this law would change is update those, expand the funding, improve the programs. And so for people that need help right now, a lot of these organizations are still active and they're working in different ways during the pandemic. For example, a lot of them have switched to texting services. So people who need help are able to use it in that way versus having to make a phone call if they're in a situation where they feel they aren't able to use that method.
This bill was introduced by then Senator Joe Biden. Now, as president, obviously, this is something that has been a key focus of his politics for many years. Do we know why that is?
Yes. At the time, he had introduced it as part of this larger bill to tackle crime. And he had said that a large piece of this was that there wasn't comprehensive legislation to address violence against women. I think more recently, it's been politically beneficial for him to cite this law because it's a way for him to show how committed he is to gender equity and issues like that. So I think over time, it's been an opportunity for him to try to spin a little bit of his work with the crime law and show, you know, also how he supported women as part of it.
What happens next in the Senate, Lee?
Next up is that Democrats say that they are ready to have a vote on this bill. And we wait to see what that bipartisan version we talked about looks like and if it comes to fruition. Last time there was an attempt at this, those talks actually broke down and Democrats ended up introducing their version and Republicans introduced their version. So it remains to be seen if they'll be able to actually find a compromise that both can get on board with.
Lee Zhou is a congressional reporter for Vox. Lee, thanks so much for your work.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to talk to you about ageism in the era of COVID-19 specifically. According to a new report from the World Health Organization, one in two people globally hold ageist views. Those are stereotypes of older and younger people based on their age, and they have long-term social health and economic consequences. But there are some generations that get left out of conversations about ageism. One of them is my own, Generation X, or dare I call us the middle-aged. In 2019, we here at The Takeaway checked in with folks in their 40s to see how they were managing the stresses of being a so-called sandwich generation, in some cases caring for their own children while also caring for their elderly family members. And if the midlife juggle was real before the pandemic, I checked in on Twitter this week to see how my fellow middle-agers have been holding up during the pandemic. Some of them said the pandemic had added to the stresses of midlife, while others said the pandemic had allowed them to find strength in community with others. But ageism isn't limited to those in their 40s. Here's what you had to say about some of your own experiences.
I've recently turned 60 and relocated to a suburb outside the Tampa, Florida area. I have experienced tremendous ageism for the first time in my life, and it has been very difficult for me to find work, even though jobs are plentiful. I recently eliminated any information about my age on my resume, which actually got me a call. At one job interview, after looking at the license and seeing my age, I was asked if I could actually walk up the stairs.
Yes, age is a stigma. And both before and after the pandemic, someone on Facebook didn't like my comment, looked at my page, and retorted with, quote, "First time on Facebook, granddad. Being disrespected is the impact." Currently, I'm working on the nuclear put-down.
When I look back, I realized that I had never met the interviewer or my boss in person before I was offered the job and started. And I wonder how many of them were surprised when I showed up. I'm 66 now. I still need to find a job because I can't afford to retire.
Now people are saying, well, let's get the older people out of the job market. Let's, you know, people should retire so that the younger people can work. But why shouldn't we have jobs? We have to live too.
Once upon a time, I was a showstopper, a major babe. Tall, blonde, lovely, young, everywhere I went, people, well, mostly men, noticed me, how I moved, what I said, what I needed, what I wanted. Then I grew old. I grew invisible. Overnight, I disappeared. No one answers when I ask a question. I enter a room, no one sees me. I don't mind. Now I don't mind, but I'm going to tell you, I did once. Oh yes, I did mind when it first happened. It comes as a shock, you know. You wake up one day and you're invisible. And the transition takes a little adjusting, but now I'm 72 years old and I've had plenty of time to get used to it. I think I've got a handle on this whole invisible thing. Think about this. If you're a woman and you have your own savings account, checking account, if you receive the same wage as men for doing the same work that those men do, if you are able to fill a birth control prescription without some man telling you it's okay, if you're able to play hockey, basketball, or soccer without getting permission, if you're employed as a lawyer, a clergywoman, a plumber, or an iron ore miner, and you can't imagine ever being denied the right to do any of those things. If you can do any of that, you should be thanking an old, invisible woman. But when you do so, and I hope you do, don't make a big deal out of it. Don't draw attention to yourself when you do it, please. We're invisible, you know, and we like it that way.
I hear so many of you callers, and I can identify with a lot of what you're saying. So thanks to everyone who left a message. And remember, you can always share your thoughts with us by recording a voice memo and emailing it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. And though ageism has existed long before the COVID-19 pandemic, sad to say, the past year has exposed just how serious and widespread the impact of ageism can be on everything from physical and mental health of older people to the economy at large. I'm joined now by Dr. Sharon Inouye, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Aging Brain Center at Hebrew Senior Life. Dr. Inouye, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Tanzina. Delighted to be here.
Also with us is Dr. Louise Aronson, professor of geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, and Reimagining Life. Dr. Aronson, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Aronson, may I start by calling you Louise and asking you about a new report from the World Health Organization that sounded the alarm about ageism as a human right and a public health issue. Was there anything that stood out to you? I mean, to me, what stood out was that one in two people have ageist views.
I think actually what stood out to me was that that sounded low.
Wow. Okay.
yes. ageism is so ubiquitous. It's so baked into all of us, even those of us who do anti-ageism work, who work with older people, that I actually found that to be a low number. It is also one of the biggest, perhaps at this point, especially with LGBTQ rights of the last few decades, the biggest internalized ism. You know, we have all sorts of movements about, you know, we're here, we're queer, black is beautiful, you know, fat rights. There's so many different groups that have said, look, we have a right, we're fully human. And the age movement, despite, you know, the Grey Panthers in the 60s and many other movements since then, is not quite there. And we see ageism in people of all ages, somewhat about the young, but more commonly about the old.
Sharon, I was going to ask you the same, a similar question to help us define ageism, because sometimes when I talk about it on social media, there will be people, as we heard our callers earlier, people who are 40, 50 and older, who are really talking about things like age discrimination at work, et cetera. But then there are people who are under 30 who say they experience ageism. How do we define it?
Sure. Well, the Oxford English Dictionary actually defines it as prejudice or discrimination on the basis of age. And that can occur at all ages. And young people definitely experience ageism, you know, getting excluded from the opportunity to apply for jobs or to do advocacy based on their age. But I wanted to call out how the WHO in their report defined ageism, because I really loved it. And they talked about stereotypes, how we think, prejudice, how we feel, and discrimination, how we act towards others or towards ourselves based on age. And I think Dr. Aronson mentioned that, you know, self-stereotypes or how we feel about ourselves as we age, I think is also a huge problem, thinking that we're not valued. And the pandemic has really shone a light on, you know, blatant ageism and negative attitudes that were openly expressed, that older adults are expendable.
I was going to say, I think that it really does, while there are instances of ageism among younger people, I think where we really start to see some of these more pernicious outcomes is among older people, as we heard at the top of the show. Louise, let's talk a little bit about how the pandemic may have, we know it's exacerbated so many things in this country and across the world in terms of economics, in terms of social issues. How has the pandemic exacerbated ageism, especially here in this country?
It's such a good question. I actually give an hour-long talk on this with some regularity, but
I'm going to listen to that at some point because I'm fascinated by the topic.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating. It actually hews to the three elements of ageism. When the term was coined by one of Dr. Inouye and my predecessors, Dr. Bob Butler, in 1969, he talked about prejudicial attitudes towards older people, old age and aging, discriminatory practices and institutional practices and policies that sort of perpetuate stereotypes. And we've seen all of this. One example is that when I give talks, and it doesn't matter whether I'm speaking to young people, old people, or somebody, you know, people in between or a mixed audience, I say, what percentage of American older adults live in nursing homes? And I will get answers that can range from 40 to 80%. The truth is it's 1%. So one of the distortions has been, you know, talking about the slaughter in nursing homes as if that's all old people. And it's kind of ironic because people can simultaneously, and this is how insidious ageism is, think all old people live in nursing homes and look at Nancy Pelosi, age 80, up until Kamala Harris's election as vice president, the most powerful woman in America, now still the second most powerful. They can look at Joe Biden.
Who's in her 50s, right? Kamala Harris?
Yeah, she's in her 50s, yeah. Mm-hmm. So depending on when ageism starts, I will say I've noticed in the bathrooms of our institution when one used to be there that there are all kinds of studies. And once you're over 50, you seem to have aged out of anybody's interest.
I'll note that for the upcoming few years that I have left in my 40s. Yes. Thank you.
I'm like, wait, you no longer care about me. Yeah. So there's been that. But there's also, you know, we saw the episodes of clotting in children. And of course, that matters. But it's quite rare. By contrast, we had evidence from Italy and China as early as a year ago, February, and we have abundant published evidence for different presentations of COVID in older adults, including a different threshold for fever. And the CDC, state health departments, and local health departments have not adopted that, although they put on their websites, they have huge sections about children. So the risk for an older adult with those presentations is 7,900 times that of a child between the ages of 5 and 17. So the risk is so much higher, but they have these built-out websites about kids and adults, and they have almost nothing about older people. It really is everywhere you look, and that sends insidious messages that old people don't matter.
Sharon, how does race, class, gender, culture, how do all of these variables factor into the experience of aging in the United States?
Yeah, Tanzina, that's a really great question. And, you know, there's really no question that ageism definitely intersects with and exacerbates other forms of disadvantage, including those related to sex and race and socioeconomic status and disability. And there's been a number of studies that have shown older women, especially women of color, experience more discrimination and more adverse health impacts than other groups. And also disabled adults have suffered tremendously during the pandemic. And older adults are also more likely to be disabled. So another example of that type of double blow that can be encountered due to the intersection of these groups.
You know, Louise, as I'm thinking about the most recent part, if you will, of this pandemic, everybody is talking about getting vaccine appointments. And one of the things that upset me personally at the very beginning when vaccines began to be distributed was just how difficult it was for people who didn't have a technical facility. And again, I don't want to assume that older people don't have facility with smartphones and technology, but some older people just didn't have access to it. Some of them, you know, it was a very confusing rollout, especially here in New York. There were multiple websites. You needed multiple hours of the day to do that. And it felt deeply unfair to particularly older people who may not have had the time or the experience needed to set those up. Is that an example of ageism, if you will? Is that a way that we, particularly during the pandemic, did not really think hard enough about our most vulnerable?
I think so. You know, we have a digital economy, and you're just right. A majority of older people use devices. Do they use them a bit differently? Yes, they are by definition not digital natives. And anybody who says, oh, that makes, you know, your average 90-year-old lame, you know, I feel sorry, because they are creating a future in which when they are 90, whatever the next thing is, they're going to be considered a lesser human. You know, we all tend to do this with jokes about music, et cetera. There are also all kinds of overlapping prejudices. So people who are lower income, and lower income people are more likely to be people of color, are less likely to have broadband access, for example. Rural populations, less likely, the oldest old. Now, one of the great things have been about the pandemic has been how many older people who thought, oh, you know, maybe that ship sailed without me, I'm not going to do it, have gotten on Zoom and done that for exercise classes and socialization. But when you have a one-size-fits-all approach to vaccination, you inevitably leave out people, and you generally leave out the most marginalized. There was a great study by Mary Bassett from Harvard in October of last year, looking at mortality differences in people aged 75 to 84. And blacks were 800 times more likely to die of COVID than whites, and Latinx populations 500 times more likely. So when we sort of talk about the pandemic as affecting people based on age or race, we actually forget the intersectionality that is actually what makes us uniquely human. So I think a single rollout is really problematic. We have also seen in my state of California, it sounds like in New York as well, that the government made one approach, strictly digital, pretty complex, according to most people, and allowed sort of and forced counties to do all the same work in each location about figuring out how to deal with populations who are universal, of people without access. And this includes some of the higher risk people like farm workers. You know, it's not just the older people. When you do a disservice to one disadvantaged population, you tend to harm lots and lots of others. I heard about a friend at a place last week in Napa County, which has lots of farm workers. Farm workers didn't show up, and instead of outreach to them, probably in Spanish, they sent out a digital call, and lots of young, healthy white people showed up. And then when there was a line many blocks long, instead of pulling people out by zip code and age, which would enable you to pick the people most deserving, and everybody needed to show an ID, which would have given that information, they just did first come, first served. And that just goes counter to everything we know would be useful. And you yet the counties probably weren't given that guidance.
And to that point, you know, Louise, what's interesting is as people begin to get vaccinated, the elderly were prioritized in many places. They are now, you know, there have been reports about how older people are starting to travel again. Older people can hug their grandchildren. The elderly, you know, brigade it can come to save many of us who are still sort of waiting for vaccines and other things. I think it's a fascinating moment to watch. And as you said, people going on Zoom and really attempting to adapt to this moment. I would love to close by hearing, Sharon, any thoughts that you have on what we need to do as a society to get past this idea that anyone over a certain age is just irrelevant.
Yeah, definitely, Tanzina. I think we need to focus to improve our healthcare systems as, you know, a major thing that was uncovered during the pandemic, and making systems that are age-friendly. And there's a big movement of age-friendly hospitals sponsored by the Institute for Healthcare Improvement that I think would take us a big step in that direction. I think involving geriatricians and people with expertise in aging in helping to find the solutions is really important. At a policy level, I think it's so important to be aware and to include aging on the agenda. And, you know, Biden's COVID Health Equity Task Force does not include an aging expert. There's 12 members, and there's really diverse representation of a lot of racial and ethnic groups, of children, of indigenous tribes, of disabled, LGBTQ, et cetera. But there is no aging expert on it. And also it links with 6 additional federal agencies, but again, none of them tasked directly with aging. So I think that's a really glaring omission, and I'm hoping that something can be done about that. Also, I want to make sure the CDC really includes aspects pertaining to aging on its website. It does not include atypical presentations of COVID, which are extremely common in older adults, as Louise already mentioned. Things like delirium should be on that list.
What is it? What's something that we should be doing in our personal lives so that we can combat ageism? I mean, is it really? It feels baked into our culture as people who live in the United States.
Right. I've actually started working on this explicitly with patients because there is fairly good data that internalized ageism harms your health. I was hoping we'd get to this, but I think we're also pandemic focused. And as Sharon and I were just texting that, you know, if we had a few hours or days, we could really do this justice. But anyway.
I want to do this topic a lot. We actually, okay. So feel we will be peeling back the layers here. But for sure, tell us what your thoughts are on this.
Great. Yeah. So there's pretty good evidence that internalized ageism increases all the same stress hormones that lead to accelerated aging in other settings, such as incarceration, such as race-related premature aging. And so there are things like you will get heart disease 7.5 years early, or you're less likely to
recover well after an illness or injury. You have more, you move on with cognitive change much sooner. And there's probably a twofold mechanism for this. Some of this is the stress hormone circulating in your body at all times. The other is a sort of fatalism that leads people not to try and not to do the health behaviors. And we see this sort of playing out in populations that have lost agency versus those that have it in terms of choices they make. There's also, of course, access to healthy food and exercise. But it's really insidious. And when I'm discussing this with people, what I'm really careful to do, and I talk about this in my book, I think I was able to write it because I entered my 50s and I was beginning to experience what you just talked about myself, and realizing that having spent my career thinking about this, I was starting to make pretty frequent ageist statements about my own aging because I'm a well-acculturated person. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, forgiving ourselves for that and understanding that that is normal and still combating it, because actually it took me a couple of years, but I've trained myself to be happy about it. I stopped dyeing my hair. And there is a joy in watching yourself develop, grow, and change, and a sort of freedom and pride and pleasure with who you are and exploring that. It makes it kind of an adventure. Now, admittedly, I'm a privileged person, so that makes things easier. I did have a moment where I thought of changing jobs, and I thought, do I need to dye my hair? So I think, you know, we have to deal in the real world. But there's also a major contradiction in our economy, where we say old people are a drag on society, and we don't want old people to work. And this also flies in the face of evidence, because a Harvard Business Review article some years ago, in the last decade, I believe, looked at all the different ways you could have diverse work teams. And an age-diverse work team led to the most productive teams. And I think it's for the same reasons people get dissed, you know, the sort of immature, too quick to act young person, the old person who, you know, has certain insights into things, but might, you know, take a little longer to learn the new technology. Or, you know, we have strengths and weaknesses that are based on age, but also, and this is equally important, based on our generational experiences, because history keeps moving forward. So we literally bring different things to the table. And my sort of last point on that, because I'm taking a lot of air here, this is Sharon and I are both crazy passionate, so she'll probably do the same thing. Is that, you know, when we set the retirement age at 65, the average age of death in America was 67. And now if you make it to your 60s, chances are you're going to your 80s or 90s. Mm-hmm. So we have these extra decades. And I'm not saying I would want to work the 70, 80-hour weeks I'm working currently when I get to that stage. I already feel more tired. I'm 57. But do I want to keep working? Yes. We know that people who work have a greater sense of purpose and self and are healthier. Plus, retirement appears to have been an epiphenomenon of the 20th century. So wealthier people have the option of continuing to work, you know, if they love what they do and it's important, you know, see Pelosi, Biden, et cetera. And poorer people, frankly, have to survive. So we cannot have a society that leads to, you know, all old people in poor houses, as has happened in most countries across history. We have developed to the point where we don't need to do that anymore.
But we don't need to do that. And yet I think there are, at least in the workplace, I think this plays out pretty often. And Sharon, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because I think there's a sense, as you mentioned, Louise, that first of all, you know, retiring at 65 is a luxury for a lot of people because of the fact that our lives don't end at 70, right? So many people, and because of the way American society is structured, are having to work whether they want to or not, quite frankly. They have mortgages to pay. They have, a wealth gap to narrow, frankly, especially if you're Black or brown in this country. There are many things, or a woman or a single parent. I can say that, you know, I, at my age, as a new and single parent, I keep thinking, my God, now I'm definitely going to have to work into my 70s, right? But there does appear to be sort of, at least institutionally, from a lot of workplaces, and a lot of younger employees, I would say, that older folk, i.e. people over 40, 45, need to just get out of the way. And that's get out of the way in terms of leadership, get out of the way in terms of taking up job space. And I think that's unfortunate because it pits two generations against each other. How do we solve for that thinking? Sharon.
Yes. Tanzina, can you hear me okay? There's a huge amount of background noise.
I can hear you fine. Control room, okay. Can you hear Sharon okay? Okay. Yep, you're fine.
So sorry about that. So I think the workplace issues are, you know, extremely important and extremely challenging. And I think there is a huge amount that can be done in terms of retraining older adults or having them apply their experience and expertise in different ways. There's so much they have to contribute, as Louise mentioned. There's so much that they can contribute, and I think just forcing them out is a very, you know, short-sighted and ultimately not wise decision on the part of employers.
Sharon, isn't there room at Oregon? I think the idea, and I was very surprised to hear what you said about the Biden administration's COVID task force not having someone there who represents, you know, aging, and given everything that we've seen with the pandemic, but also just, isn't there a case to be made for having that type of representation? I feel like a lot of companies are saying, okay, well, let's bring in only young people at the top, or, you know, we'll start cutting people's employment lives off at 40, 45 years old. And I wish we could get to a place where we can value both younger perspectives and older perspectives at the table at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally agree with that. And there's actually been economic studies done by, for instance, Harvard economist David Bloom, who's shown that older workers, you know, have the potential to bring billions of dollars into the U.S. economy. And so it's not, you know, it's unwise to exclude them based on age for so many reasons. They actually will enhance the workplace, as Louise said. You know, there's better productivity, there's better products developed, more efficiency if you include older workers. So I think there really has to be a change in that. But I think that part of the problem is it's coming from the negative stereotypes that are just propagated everywhere about ageism. And, you know, in the media, you don't often see very realistic or sympathetic portraits of older adults. You too often see them portrayed as, you know, batty or forgetful or, you know, not vital human beings.
Or God forbid, boomers.
Boomers, exactly. And the whole boomer term, right, has become a negative term, you know, portraying someone who's closed-minded or resistant to change. And I think, you know, developing intergenerational ties and connections is so important. And the more we can do that and the more we can build that, I think it will make a difference.
We should all have friends from multiple generations.
Exactly.
Definitely.
Thanks to you both so much for joining us. I could talk about this topic for as long as I'm sure you guys could talk about it to me. Hopefully we will be revisiting this in the future. It's something that I find very, very important and something that I think this country has to figure out. Dr. Sharon Inouye is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Louise Aronson is a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Thanks to you both for joining us about this important topic.
Thanks for covering it.
I haven't experienced ageism yet, but I'm about to be 45 years old. Everybody always thinks I'm like 15 years younger. So I'm sure the years are going to start catching up to me anytime now. And when that happens, the ageism will probably follow. So I'm expecting it to kick in pretty soon. But, you know, I've had a good run, so I have no complaints.
Hi, my name is Michelle, and I am from New York. I feel that I see ageism every single day. As an older adult, I feel that I am invisible to advertisers unless the advertising is for me to get rid of my wrinkles, cover up my brown spots, provide for my funeral, or perhaps get a reverse mortgage. I feel that the stereotype senior is being portrayed as unattractive. That's why we need the wrinkle cream. We're not very well off. Our funeral could possibly be a burden on our family. We fall a lot, we're clumsy, hard of hearing, incompetent, forgetful. We need a lot of medications, and we're very unaware of all of these problems. The message I get is that we are an unattractive nuisance that someone has to take care of. To watch these ads that are directed at me, you would think I have completely different needs than everyone else. I must not shop, buy cars, go out to eat, go on any vacations, because no one targets my age group for those ads. I don't know why our culture treats older adults this way. Everyone ages, we all add on the years, and even the okay boomer generation will not be able to stay young forever.
Want to be a part of the takeaway? Record your take as a voice memo on your phone. Email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com and make your voice heard. Or call us at 877-869-8253.
You can check out the series I mentioned, The Juggle, at thetakeaway.org under our special projects page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.